Blog Talk Radio. evening, everyone. Welcome to Dry Bones Connection on Thursday night. This is Antoinette, and tonight we're going to have with us Judge Joe Brown, and we're going to be discussing his run for mayor. We're still waiting for the judge to come in, so while we're waiting, I'm going to play you another song. This one is by Sam Cooke.
But I know a change gon' come. Oh, yes it will. I go to the movie and I go downtown. Somebody keep telling me don't. But I know a change gon' come. Oh, yes it will. Then I go to my brother and I say, brother, help me please. But he winds up knocking me back down on my knees. Oh, there've been times that I thought I couldn't last for long, but now I think I'm able. But I know a change gon' come. Oh, yes it will.
All right, folks, well, we're back and we have with us Judge Joe Brown. Good evening, Judge Joe. How are you?
Good evening. How are you?
I'm well, thank you. How are you?
I'm doing fine.
Well, that's good to hear. I know everyone has their mind on you running for mayor and then all the things that's going on in Tennessee right now. But I hate to just jump right in. But can you tell me, what is the reason why you want to run for mayor, that you want to be mayor?
Duty and responsibility. This city has gone down a rabbit hole, and somebody needs to rescue it before it gets too far. We've got corruption from the gutter to the top, and we have to do something to turn it around. The city needs leadership. We need restructuring of the police department. We need the streets fixed. That's the people and the potholes. We need the infrastructure repaired. That's human and physical. We need to bring in energy, and we have the means with the Mississippi River to do that. We are the distribution capital of North America. We need to take advantage of that. We've got Ford and Cadillac getting ready to build electric cars nearby, and we need to do something about getting involved with the exportation and the development of that so we become the Detroit for the 21st century. We have everything we need, but we do not have any effective leadership. Too much of what we have in place either are some small-minded people with a social agenda they're trying to push, or they're crooks, and their ideas of what to do basically amount to transparent scams where they can get funds that they can distribute under or over the table to themselves and their cronies. And we've gone too far in the wrong direction with that. This city needs redirection. It's got a large population. It's 65% black. The police department is majority black. 60% of the criminal judges are black. 60% of them are women. You need to deal with the opportunities that that presents instead of throwing it away on individuals who have not done anything for the communities that elect them. There are some exceptions, but they are way too few. So it's time to change that. So it's a little bit of follow me leadership. In other words, get behind me, I'll be out in front, and let's see how far we can go rather than, oh my God, we need some ideas, so I'm going to appoint some kind of committee or set up some kind of program staffed by bureaucrats who don't have a clue either so we can steal some more money. And that's what's going on here. This is one of the most corrupt places in America. So that has to change.
So yes, it does. I agree with
it's
that.
JJ. So I'm running. It's JJB for mayor of Memphis, Tennessee in 2023. Send Brown downtown and take back your town. And this, by the way, can be a mecca for everybody. And we invite people to come here, but just be legal. This will not be a sanctuary city.
Okay, well, that's good. So that's right, good. Now, what strategies do you have to reduce crime?
Same thing I started doing, let's see, now it's 33 years ago. Over a 10-year period, they did a study. The statewide recidivism rate for felons was 80%. That means 80% of them would be back again. In my courtroom, it got dropped down to just 18%. Those programs and, well, not programs, those strategies and tactics are still in my head. They've been developed over the last 20-some years. So being in a mayor's office gives you access to making them more effective than they were when you were just a judge. So there we go. It involves getting the unions involved and developing apprentices. It involves itself with developing character, which is the fundamental lack right now. And it means that somebody actually instills a purpose and a cause in the youth so they have something to look forward to so when they get confronted with adversity, they don't give up and assume they're dead and it's hopeless and resort to coming up with some kind of scam they can pull off where they'll get what they want the easy way, and they can become committed to a cause, which I will give them. So every morning when they look in the mirror, they'll be asking themselves whether they acted like a man or a woman the day before, whether they're going to do better about being a man or a woman that day, and whether they're preparing to be better tomorrow. So when times get hard, they don't sit there and give up. They just struggle harder because they now have a purpose. And it works amazingly well. There are methods of raising boys to be effective men and also women, too, that have been in effect for thousands of years. The Roman legions had them. The Marine Corps has them. The Boy Scouts once had them. The ordinary people anywhere had them. But we seem to have gotten away from that, and we have fallen under the sway of people who want to destroy the fabric of society for their own selfish purposes. That cannot go on. And in any event, this country is about to face, well, this country is about to see a bad backlash. Now, the backlash can be totally vicious or it can be tempered, but something has to be done. So I've been about the business for a long time of protecting womanhood and promoting manhood. And, of course, there are those who say that's outrageous. Well, you know, good for you if that's the way you think. First Amendment rights that you have allow you to do that and speak about it. But for half a century, I've been dealing with what happens when people don't understand certain things, and I've had to clean up the messes or deal with the tragedies. So you can either listen and learn, or you can go learn it the hard way. And last I checked, by the way, there are too many drive-bys and crazy things that are going on that show boys who have not been acculturated and socialized into manhood. But we have to change that.
Yes, we do. Now, Joe, you know, this problem is not just against the citizens, the everyday layman people, but is also against the police force, against the law officials that are in Tennessee. You know, as we've seen with, you know, the young boy that was, young man that was beaten to death. And what made
that really had nothing to
correct
do with
that?
That had nothing to do with the police department. That had to do with some young men who happened to be police.
Yes.
In other words, it's not endemic to the police force here. It was that certain individuals on the police force, for old-time reasons, decided that they had a target for a specific reason. And it's one of the old-time reasons that the allegations and things that are out there on the street are correct. And that needs to be addressed. And what we actually saw was a failure of command authority from mid-level management in the police department on up, because there's no backup in the chief's office. And the mayor that we have had in for the last 8 years is outright incompetent. He has no business being the mayor. He snuck in. There were some problems with corrupted voting machines that kept him in. And on top of that, his interests are making some of his cronies wealthier and getting a piece of that action himself rather than correcting problems. The group he represents prospered by the through the breakdown. Now, some of these things, like what happened, you're talking about the Tyre Nichols thing, will be falling in my lap when I become mayor. And the other point that is of concern to me right now, in the last 25 months this week, we have now 662 families who have lost loved ones through crazy violence. And the Tyre Nichols family, such as it is only one of those families. So I am concerned about everybody's family, not just one. And I do not think it is appropriate for some of the people who have been involved in this to be playing hyena or vulture to feast off of the carcass of a tragedy.
Yeah. Now, but the present mayor, what is he doing to address this problem?
Nothing.
Okay.
Here's what I said. If you have the ability to deal with this problem, you also could walk through any neighborhood in this city without an armed escort and come back after it got dark, whole and sound, because the people themselves would protect you as their representative or their leader. Most of the people involved in this cannot do this. They have no connection with the people.
Yes. Well, that's unfortunate because you have to have that.
If you walk around Memphis with me, you'll find that people come up, "Judge, you remember me?" And I'll say, "No, sir, I don't." "Well, you gave me some time." And then I'll crack, "Did I give you enough?" "Oh, no, see, it's that thing about manhood and responsibility. I thought you were crazy, but when I peeped what you were talking about, you know, it's been 29 years since you had a hold of me, and you straightened me out, and, you know, I've got grandchildren, and all of my children are doing well. I've been married for 27 of the last 29 years, and I'm glad you got me together because I haven't had any problems since, and I got a bunch of kids in the neighborhood. I'm trying to teach what you taught me." See, that's how you do it.
All right, and that's good. Yeah, that's good. So you're still in touch with the black in the black neighborhood? You're still working in there to work
all
with,
the time.
You know,
I
these
mean,
young
I,
people.
I never left.
Well, that's
see,
good.
I've always been involved. I grew up in South Central Los Angeles, and I was in LA from kindergarten through law school. But I've been by choice in Memphis, Tennessee, for the last half century.
Okay,
so,
well, that's good.
I suppose I'm a native. I flew back and forth to L.A. a lot, had places to stay out in the Los Angeles area, but, you know, I was registered to vote continuously here.
Well, that's good. Judge Joe, now, if I was in Memphis, if I lived in Memphis, what separates you from the other candidates that I should vote for you?
I just told you.
Yes.
You got
okay,
a jackass who is being termed out. He can't run anymore. They tried to put a referendum on the ballot that got soundly defeated to allow him to run for another term. Nobody wants him. White, black, brown, red, yellow. He's a failure. They have one person who is lusting about getting in charge because he's already got scams going where close to $1 billion worth of tax money have been diverted or will be diverted to the interest he represents, and those are not the interest of the people. There's another somebody who is trying to get personally wealthy off of the taxpayers, and some of the deals he's pulled off have been very questionable. There's one gentleman in who has done okay, but he's gotten kind of out of there, and he's got a lot of flack he's got to deal with. One person just got elected sheriff this last August. And he's running for mayor now, and he's got enough problems in his jail, which is in the building where his office is. And there have been too many deaths down in that jail, and these people haven't even been convicted. He's got to get that straightened out.
Yeah.
There is one person who, to give an exemplar, she's been in a state legislative office for 8 years, and in that 8 years, she's gotten $370,000 in campaign contributions from some people that you could probably aptly term them enemies of the people. And in contrast, there was a sterling representative of the people, the late Dr. Barbara Cooper, who held an office for 30 years. And instead of $370,000 over that 30-year period, she got just $1,500 from the same lobbying interest. You've got another somebody who's been a participant in the Board of Education that is an abject failure to the people. You've got another somebody in there that is a preacher, and his wife has been supplying him with money because he postures about he's a businessman, but it's his wife's money, and he wants to get in, but he has no connection with the people. You have, let's see, somebody white who represents a super district on the city council, and he represents not necessarily big business or high finance. He represents a certain select industry, and his idea is forget about the citizens and promote tourism because the city wants more sales tax, so it can do something with the sales tax, which actually means more money to pay out to the people that they represent. Now, we've got stuff that looks like it's progressive. The Memphis City Council has approved $5 million for a study of reparations, but I find it extraordinary since the majority of the city council is black. Most of them are relatively young. So you hold yourself out and get public office and you have no ideas about restitution and you want to conduct the study. And since the city is 65% black and it pays the overwhelming majority of the property taxes and the sales taxes that are paid in this area, you want them to pay for their own restitution? That doesn't make any sense. There are people that are already on the payroll of the city who know something about the subject and ought to be charged with doing the study, so you don't need $5 million worth of money that is so tempting when it comes to putting it under the table to the people that don't have any interest in reparations or even across the table to cronies who have another agenda beside that. So I have some ideas that might do something about it. Now, it's time you got somebody that knew what they were doing when they got in the mayor's office instead of just being a rank amateur getting in with an idea of how to make a quick buck.
Yeah, you're right about that. Most definitely. Judge, what is your opinion? Have you heard about the Tennessee do away with, I guess, the lethal injection, Representative Paul Sherrill? Am I saying his name correctly? I'm sure I'm not. Sherrill.
I don't remember names. What's supposed to have been done? I'm not.
He has suggested for executing death row inmates by hanging them from a tree.
It was sarcastic. It was a joke. It wasn't to be taken seriously. What they wound up doing is giving a condemned prisoner a choice of methods of execution. The methodology was expanded from the electric chair, which is actually pretty nasty because when they execute somebody by electric chair, they literally fry like a piece of bacon, sizzle with the grease and everything flowing and spluttering. And they added to the mix the choices available, firing squad. So it wasn't to be taken seriously. A lot of people were trying to make something of it, but that's just irresponsible journalism.
Yeah.
In other words, it was proposed tongue-in-cheek. It wasn't meant to be taken seriously.
Well, that's a good thing. That's very good.
Execution. I always thought it was kind of nice, nasty to quietly execute somebody by lethal injection behind closed doors. If you're going to execute somebody, you ought to co-opt all of the local stations and carry the execution live so people will get the full deterrent effect and understand what it is they're supporting. I always found it interesting that when juries impose the death penalty, you'd have 12 jurors coming back in the box and 10 of them would be bawling their eyes out crying about what they just got through doing. And they'd call you up for months afterward talking about they couldn't sleep. Did they do the right thing?
Yeah, I wouldn't want to see it.
What'd you say?
I said I wouldn't want to see that.
Well, it happened.
I wouldn't want to see anybody executed.
Well, they used to do that as a deterrent factor. Now, the truth of the matter is execution as a nebulous concept right now has very little deterrent factor. And in fact, in my years of dealing with these things, it's actually an incentive to commit a homicide because a lot of people hate themselves. And just like you have suicide by cop, you've got suicide by neighbor. And if you can promise somebody that they'll die for killing someone, well, anecdote, only two times I had anybody go off in my courtroom were on two occasions where the DA's office announced that they were not going to seek the death penalty. And in each instance, the defendant in question jumped up and started hollering about, they're going to have to kill me. I'm not doing life. I'll kill somebody else. They're going to have to execute me, et cetera, et cetera. If you have a person who doesn't respect his own life, hates himself, he has no respect for anybody else's. So the death penalty became an incentive. You can see that in Mario Puzo's book, The Godfather. This character, Luca Brasi, that in the movie series was somebody that only Marlon Brando's character would deal with. He was so bad. The old Godfather telling his son, Michael, he says, you need to find yourself a Luca. Luca hates his own guts, but he doesn't have the nerve to kill himself. So he will kill anybody, do anything to anybody, hoping to provoke someone to do him the personal favor of taking his life. If he gets the chair, he won't squeal because that's exactly what he wants. Just make sure you do what I did with Luca and make yourself the only person in the world that individual doesn't want to be the one that kills him.
Very harsh reality, but unfortunately, we do have people that feel that way.
There are a lot of people like that. For 50 years, day in, day out, as a defense lawyer, as the chief public defender for the city, as the criminal court judge, some of these people are not good humans. Some of them are sociopaths. Some of them are just plain sick. A lot of them are marginally mentally ill. They don't qualify as not guilty by reason of insanity. But some people I've represented and other people I've had to deal with, I didn't particularly want them walking around in the free world because I've got friends, relatives, and people that are close to me out there that they might come in contact with.
Yeah.
And by the way, there's just about all the righteous brothers are in the penitentiary and we need to let them out. No, you don't need to let everybody out of jail. There's some people that should be there. And here's the other thing. Out of all the people in American prisons, over the last 50 years, the stats have been pretty consistent. Just a little less than 2.5% are in there because they got convicted by a jury. More than 97% pled guilty, and out of that, 84 to 87% confessed. And I know there are all these stories about coerced confessions and everything else, but you should see some of the video clips of the confessions where the OG that's sitting in your courtroom when you have a recess so you can go back in chambers with defense and prosecution and the court reporter to look at the tapes of these confessions. This OG gangster in your courtroom back there when you see him on tape is crying like a baby with snot running down his face, tears, and using up half a box of Kleenex, and the detectives are trying to tell him, young man, you really need to get a lawyer. We'll stop right now. May I suggest? And he's talking about he doesn't want a lawyer. He wants to see his mama, and they explain to them that his mama can't come since he's not an attorney. And then they offer, if you just let me see my mama, I'll tell on everybody. And then they name all of the accomplices that the police have been trying to find out who they were, and he's naming them. See, in this honor, you know, they tell on each other all the time. That's how most of this stuff gets solved, because 98% of the time there's snitches. And every now and then one of them has sense and paid attention to some of the cops and robber stuff. You have a right to remain silent, and they do, and nobody can prove a case on them. Because under American law, you can't convict anybody on the uncorroborated evidence of an accomplice. So,
yeah.
And most of the people in the penitentiary are not in there for playing Robin Hood. They are in there for robbing the hood.
Yeah, that's true as well.
Word
up, yes.
Mike, on that.
Yes. Judge Stowe, in the past, you have made a statement against women holding the job as
I've
mayor.
I've never made a statement against women. Never. Never.
Okay, against being mayor, that because of the conditions in Memphis.
I've never made
a
statement against women being mayor. Never.
Okay, forgive me. Forgive me.
What I said was...
Okay, go ahead.
What I said, no, that's crap. There were 150 women in this night, not women, there were 150 people in this nightclub. There were 23
yes.
people that signed in for the Young Democrats, and they came downstairs in the nightclub to try and have an acquainted meeting. I wasn't invited. I crashed. And what went on
yes.
is outside of those 23, there were people standing up and shouting. I had about 18 to maybe a little more than 20 women volunteered to work for the campaign. What I did was quote a 19-year-old female college student. And it was this. I had belabored this point about whoever is the next mayor needs to be able to deal with the young thugs out in the street up close and personal and lead them to being peaceful people who are trying to be men and doing what men do. And I said some of the places I will be going and that the next mayor needs to go to will be very dangerous people. And if a woman right now were to go there, she likely, in the rape capital of America, would wind up getting raped. Now, what happened? Within 24 hours of me saying that, an affluent woman disregarded the advice of her friends not to do it. She jogged early morning when it was still dark. She got kidnapped, tortured, raped, and murdered. Not 24 hours after I said, yes, this is the rape capital of America. And if you have to go out and deal with hands-on, you don't, you know, right now, this is wartime.
Yes.
A declared war. And my motto, protecting womanhood and promoting manhood. So protecting womanhood means it's my job to get out there and confront the danger. And if you can't confront the thug and try to convert him into a man, you have a problem. And these boys aren't getting raised right, and they have disrespect for their mothers. And you expect a mother stand-in to go in and be able to tell them and convince them to get off of the street? Not now, later. And I qualified that. I said, not right now. Maybe the next one. I have to make it safe, which is what I have been doing my whole adult life. There are a whole lot of women that I've known for years. I forgot where I met them. And they tell me, you don't remember when you met me. No, I really don't. You were driving down the street, and I ran out of my apartment. And I was screaming, you parked your car in the middle of the street, and there was somebody trying to assault me or rape me or had broken into my apartment, and you cleared the matter up. Oh, I do remember that. You see?
Yes.
And then the people that were upset about it, they wanted to say that I was being sexist because I said women need protection. I said, well, you may think you don't, but for 50 years I've been dealing with a whole lot who said they didn't, but I looked at them as very tragic victims when they were crying on the witness stand, or I was looking at the medical examiner's photographs of their dead bodies. Now, what you want to think about is one thing, what the reality is may not be pleasing. It's like walking down in the hood with a whole roll of cash in your pocket. You have every right to have that U.S. currency in your pocket, but if you flash it, you better be able to handle yourself, because somebody, sure enough, will try to hijack you.
Yeah.
So it's a matter of, okay, you want to be the superstar celebrity? Do you have bodyguards? And I had bodyguards, but my agreement with them, since I had taken more martial arts than most of them and shot better than most of them, I just said, I tell you what, all I want you to do is watch my back, because I don't want you to take a bullet for me. That's not your job. That's my job. So we will cooperate in keeping peace around in the space I'm in. Now, that's okay, the way reality goes.
Yes. And you brought up,
now,
you go to the range. Go ahead.
Do I go to the range?
I said you go to the gun range. Now, what would be your position on gun control in Memphis?
Well, the crooks don't need the guns, but the crooks don't buy the guns at the gun stores or any of the very few gun shows that have been had in the last few years. They get them supplied from thefts. They have 18-wheeler loads of firearms, serious hardware to get hijacked. They're on the way with a new delivery from Smith & Wesson or Beretta or SIG to the local state police or a state police set or the local sheriff's department. They get hijacked. When you get a shipment of dope that the war on drugs can't stop, there are always cases of guns that come in with the heavy smuggled drugs. A lot of guns that are used in crime come from the police. They drop them in bathrooms or leave them out on cars. We just got a new chief of police. She hadn't been here 2 weeks when her sidearm was stolen, and the word is it was found to have been used in a crime 3 weeks later. See, children and irresponsible criminals don't need to be armed. But if you disarm innocent, good citizens, you don't do the good citizen any favor, because the criminals are already quite well armed, and they'll kill the innocent citizens, rob them up, and act with what they think is impunity. And the theory on it, you see it all the time. Why does the U.S. Department of Defense think it has to keep up with the Russian military or the Chinese military? Called deterrence.
Yeah,
wow. So areas in Memphis where you have the greatest number of legitimately armed good citizens have the lowest violent crime rates.
Well, that's good.
Now,
that's very good.
So I have a plan, by the way, to interface the people with the operation of the police. Instead of civilian oversight, we will have civilian control and direction of the department. Just like, guess where you have that? The United States Department of Defense. The commander-in-chief, the president, is a civilian. The secretary of defense is a civilian. Secretary of Army, Navy, Air Force, etc., they are civilians. They are subsecretaries of defense who are civilians. So we need to have that where the commander is a civilian, the director of police, which is what we've had for five decades until this crook that's in the office right now decided he's going to appoint the first civil service chief in more than 42 years. And this person was demoted and fired in Atlanta for malfeasance, rehired after a civil service hearing, and then resigned and went on to Raleigh-Durham, North Carolina, where she got into the same problems. And guess what the problem was? The person that she was protecting is now doing a 10-year federal sentence for conducting pornography production ring.
Oh, no.
Yes.
Oh, Lord, that's horrible.
So why is that person chief of police in Memphis instead of perhaps being the director? And then we have lots of fine women who have been in command positions in the Memphis Police Department who were overlooked, who have outstanding records, and a lot of them I know personally.
So tell
me what's going on with the crooks. What better thing for the foxes than to have another fox running the hen coop?
Shoot, it's all the same. I mean, it's not going to accomplish anything except corruption.
No, it's not. And the biggest problem with our police department right now is a lack of command authority and control. There's nothing coming down from the top because there's nothing at the top. The people that are up there are not used to exercising command authority. They don't know how to do it, and they neglect it. They hope somebody else will take care of it, but they are responsible. What did Harry Truman say 70 years ago when he was in the White House? 74 years ago when he was in the White House. He said, the buck stopped here.
Yes. So you're going to have it stop with you.
Yeah, with me. But it doesn't seem to be the operative consideration here right now. It's always somebody else's fault. Oh, no, it's not anybody's fault. These things just happen, and there's nothing we can do about them. Let's complain about them so maybe we can feel sorry for each other. But, you know, did you ever read this book, Men Are From Mars and Women Are From Venus?
No, I've heard about it, but I've never read it.
Well, what they want is somebody to understand their pain rather than to have somebody to come up with solutions. I have solutions. They've worked for me personally with the individuals I've dealt with, which are quite considerable since, to give you an idea, we only had 10 criminal court judges. But we were the fifth largest criminal jurisdiction in America at the time, behind L.A., New York, Chicago, Dallas, Memphis, Houston, Miami, Detroit. Houston had almost 50 divisions of criminal court. We only had 10. We had some very heavy loads, and we were very efficient with how we handle business. So I had essentially responsibility for handling one-tenth of the fifth largest criminal load in the United States, and I got some good lab research and feedback on programs that I came up with to correct the problems. They correct the problems.
Yes.
And we need that on a bigger basis.
Yes.
Larger scale. Yes. The people want leadership, somebody that will inspire them so not just there's some nebulous hope, but they can see their pathway to where they need to get to. Somebody is showing them how to do it, not just talking grand little phrases with no policy that they can actually put into effect, where you have somebody bragging about what they've done for black folk, and you say, well, wait a minute. You got rid of the statues of the Johnny Rebs, fine, but you bought this park for just $2,500 that got sold to you for no bid for $2,500. And now these hospitals want to put a $2.5 billion hotel where that park is. And since your company now owns it, how much money are you getting per month in rent for this?
Yes.
That's not helping anybody else because you got some Johnny Reb statues taken down. Oh, we need the downtown skyline improved. That's the first thing Memphis needs. And you are running a program trying to lobby to get downtown parking restricted to just those who live downtown, and everybody else has to take a bus downtown. And guess how much you want to spend of the tax dollars to help a major international hotel chain finance a hotel expansion downtown to improve the skyline? $250 million. And we can't get potholes fixed and there are no subsidies for summertime employment for youth that would help out small businessmen of any color persuasion.
Oh, wow.
Is that helping out anybody?
No, it's not. I mean, things have definitely got to change. It definitely got to change.
See, that's what's going wrong. People are getting sold a bill of goods, and also I know that on popular media you can't talk about election fraud, but under the Bush administration, under the Obama administration, under the Trump administration, and also under the current Biden administration, the Justice Department said repeatedly, there has not been a straight-up fair election in Shelby County, where Memphis is located, since the year 2000. Their machines operate on Windows 2000 technology. There never was a firewall. There never was a security system. There are no available upgrades because you can access the outcome of the entire election from any one machine. You can corrupt the whole process from any one machine. California got so upset about the whole thing that they threw theirs in the ocean. So did Hawaii. Ohio threw theirs in the lake. Florida got rid of theirs, and California published a little pamphlet online some years ago about how to hack the machines using a cell phone. And let's see, it's been 15 years ago the Justice Department put up the money to replace all of these corrupted machines. That was in 2008, but nobody's done that until this last election cycle. And it threw a lot of people off because individuals that the news media thought were going to win hands down lost very badly because there were no hacked machines. Now, let's see what happens when you get fair voting machines in here and people really have to depend upon the people making their choices known through an election rather than having a private selection. It might be interesting.
Yeah. Yes, it might be. It should be very interesting. What would be your major initiatives? What would be your major initiatives on the first, well, let's say 100 days? What would be your top priority?
First thing, setting up an ombudsman bureau. What is that? That's people who can go outside of chains of command and ask anybody and everybody what's going on, report back to me. To start off by having informants, so to speak, check on the operation of the city bureaus and agencies, to go out and check on the police, report back, and when you made a call on a zoning violation, how long did it take them to report? When they got there, did you tell them about the problem next door, and did they tell you they could handle it, or did they say, not my problem, you got to call again? What happened? Who is doing wrong in your department? Let us know. Do you have any suggestions? Line of communications are open. We have to start that. That can be done in the first few days. Let's take an assessment of what I think is a very important thing. Let's have an audit done of the city books. I've already done an off-the-cuff one several years ago. Let's see where the money, which is a lot, coming in is going to and what benefit the people get out of it. How many of these things where you have a situation where, while we whoopee, you've got a $250,000 evaluated property that got bought by somebody for $750 and the city's renting it back for $1,500 a month? What the devil's going on there? Let's get up the start of where we're going to go to get the city back to being in a whole financial position. Let's start doing what we need to do about where the city deposits go so that can be spread around so other banks can have a number of, well, a sum of the city's funds on deposit so they can extend the number of loans, credit lines that they can have out to ordinary middle-class people for home purchasing, for purposes of setting up small businesses, for encouraging the development of credit unions and alternative banks. Okay, we're going to start dealing with the people I already know who are pretty good cops, honest cops, and we're going to start setting up a command structure. We're going to start having the police deal with finding territories where we can have some firing ranges where the police can teach the people how to shoot and when to shoot. That will familiarize cops with the people they represent. We have a constitutional carry here where if it's legal for you to buy the weapon, you can carry the weapon. So somebody needs to put in place training. We need to start taking back our schools, and since we are the majority taxpayers in the county board of education, we need to see who's getting paid what. Like, why is it that we have a fully funded legal the county board of education, yet they hire an old long-term black silk stocking upscale law firm that they pay $500 to $1,500 an hour to do routine in-office work? All right, let's start bringing in some of the representatives of you from Europe who want to deal with direct trafficking from Europe by sea to Memphis. Why are they getting turned down? Let's bring them in and start talking to them and start making some arrangements. Okay, what about these properties out here that we have that already have huge concrete slab floorings that are set up that certain industries want to get into? Let's start making it attractive for them to get in here so people don't have to worry about minimum wage. They can get to talking about $72.18 an hour, $134.19 an hour instead of what they talk about here. Let's start dealing with situations so when we take this school back, we can also start setting up alternative programs so the kids get vocational training as well as academic preparation. We get a situation so we don't have what I've seen where I went in one high school to speak, and I'm talking to the principal who was really trying, and I'm looking at this fairly attractive girl student, I thought, leaning up against the corner with her arm folded. She had on some little spaghetti strap sandals, some tight-knit booty shorts with her butt cheeks out the back, and a little halter tied in the front and the belly ring. I said, sir, do you let your students dress like that? Judge, that's not a student. That's a teacher. We're not permitted to talk to them about dress codes.
Oh, no.
We can't have. See, these kind of things are way wrong.
Yes,
like Memphis
are.
Light, Gas, and Water. When I got here 50 years ago, a half century ago, the weather patterns are different. There would be snow on the ground regularly and continuously from late December all the way through March. There hardly is now any snow. But everything breaks down if there's a light rain. What happened to the infrastructure of the utility company, and why did somebody decide to privatize the thing instead of keeping it under the city's control? What happened when you fired somebody that was making sure that he retired? Why is it now that everything breaks down when continuously during the period this guy was in, nothing happened? Everything ran like clockwork, and now the power goes down regularly. People have regular blackouts. The cell phone service is absolutely corrupted around here. You've got zoning variances granted out that completely destroy the city planning. You've got situations where you come in and gentrify, and you've got no plans as to where you're going to put the people who are displaced. So you wind up tearing down middle-class neighborhoods, and you don't care about what happens. That's got to stop. That can, right on, I know what I want to do. So in other words, it's bringing in the people that need to be in these positions, and there are a lot of people that should. But interestingly enough, when ordinary people find out who's running a committee, say, who is that? I've never heard of him. I haven't either. turns out to be a crony. We need to stop dealing with cronies and deal with competence. I don't care. I'm too old. I've made my money. I'm set for life. I don't have problems. I don't need to make another dime to be able to die in good financial condition. So my job is to take these two terms that are available, since they're term limits, tell everybody to go to hell who doesn't like it. We are going to set this up for the people, for the benefit of the people, by the people, and we're going to involve the people in the process of making it better for themselves. Now,
well, that's
in other
good.
Words,
that's good.
We're going to hit the ground running. There's no learning curve.
Now, you brought
and
up about the education
people,
and schools. I'm sorry.
See, one thing I'd say this. Most of the people in charge, I was in my profession before they were born. So I saw them as children. I saw some of them be turned into spoiled brats, and they still act that way. There were a few people around who have impressed me with their integrity through life. But they get overwhelmed by the ones that are just interested in becoming millionaires with a job that pays $28,000 a year part-time.
Yeah.
So that's
yeah.
not right.
Yeah,
that's for people that
no,
know what they're
not.
Doing.
Yes. Now, let me ask you, I don't know about Memphis as far as their school districts and everything is, and what they cover, their curriculum. But how do you feel about Black history being taught in schools with everything with this?
Black history's right.
Curriculum?
But not in the damn Black studies. Black history. We study history to learn its lessons, to apply those lessons to our current conduct so that our tomorrows are as we wanted them to be. When you start talking about little social stuff and all you're dealing with is somebody was a ballet dancer or somebody buck danced and sang, that doesn't have any messages or any lessons to be learned for history. Let's talk about history. See, 1967, myself, several other students who were Black students in the UCLA's BSU, along with a few Black faculty, we drew up a prospectus for Black history. We got it implemented. It was a dangerous thing because there was high competition to take the program over. Two people that I recruited to UCLA, John Huggins and Bunchy Carter, they were Black Panthers. They got gunned down by a rival organization that wanted to take control of the Black history program. Now it's Black studies. 50-some years later, and when you go over to the building that is in now, which is the biggest on campus, you've got people hanging around drinking Chablis in the faculty lounge with the little pinky fingers talking about, oh, Alan, don't you think these wafers are so tasty? And pass one of those sausages. Oh, they're just divine. What the hell? We were supposed
yeah.
to be getting Black students angry enough to focus on coming up with a means of changing stuff, and all you're doing is coming up with a social program. What is the matter? That should be taught through sociology. That should be taught through psychology. That should be a matter of philosophy. That should be in the theater arts department. That's not Black history.
Now, would you consider having a town hall and having the people come together?
I have
to...
one every month. I have
okay,
one every
great.
Month already. Now, another thing,
yes.
let's talk about the education. When
yes.
the city gave up its educational charter and turned it over to the county, they said it was to save money. Actually, they wanted to get more money to do what they did under the table. But let's talk about what happened. When it went to the county, it got privatized. So they turned it over to an adjunct of Teach America. Now Teach America is in charge of training, selecting, hiring, and assigning teachers. So we had some outstanding teachers on who were getting paid $80,000, $90,000, $100,000 a year. They had master's degrees, PhDs. They'd been there for 25 years, been written up in all of the literature about being outstanding teachers. Well, that wasn't good for business when you're talking about making a profit. So they fired all of them by pretext, almost. And what happens now is the teachers don't even need a four-year college degree. A two-year associate degree will suffice. And depending upon whether you have a two-year degree, you have a four-year degree, you now start at $28,000 to $34,000 a year, which is a poverty income for being a teacher. Why should you teach? Well, if you teach at an inner-city school for 2 years, you get your student loans forgiven. And if you're trying to send your boyfriend, significant other, husband, or whatever it may be, through law school, medical school, dental school, getting his MBA or whatever it may be, then, you know, that's a bonus for you and you got everything together and you'll live happily ever after and screw the folk down there in the hood. So that's what we have right now, which is causing the educational process to really go downhill on a bobsled, on an icy slick. Yeah. You've got to stop it. They don't even have a retirement program for people.
No?
No.
How the hell did they get started with that?
That's the problem. How are you going to get an adequate teaching staff when you don't have a retirement plan? Now, what they're doing is they are hiring people who are nominally substitute teachers who have four-year degrees or doctoral equivalents to work part-time to fill in these positions. But they are 67, 68, 69 years old. They're retired, and they're just doing it trying to make ends meet because their retirement didn't work out. Do you know what I get paid as a pension by the state of Tennessee for getting elected to 16 years worth of being a state trial judge? Do you know what it is per month?
No, I don't.
$1,863 a month. Now, how are you supposed to live off of that? You can't.
You can't.
So if you have...
No, you can't.
You can't. That won't even pay for your medication as an old person. So if you haven't
that
set something up, you can't retire. And so people have to keep working way beyond when they would ordinarily be expected to be. That's why you got 89-year-old judges on the bench. They can't afford to retire.
Yeah. No, no,
so
you don't have a retirement program set up.
Well, for the judges, but I mean for civil service folk, yeah. But $1,800 a month, you're not going to do much living off of that.
No, you're not. That's going to put you on the poverty line.
It works out. Yes. So you start your school teachers off below the poverty line. They'd get more getting a welfare check.
Yeah. Yeah.
And we let that happen.
Oh, my.
You've got one selector where the latest lease expired 30 years ago. The people that hold the leases are on a month-to-month tenancy. They pay the city $250 to $500 a month to keep the leases going month-to-month. But they sublease the lots in question for between $8,000 to $9,000 a month, and I think the highest is $43,000 a month. Still allowed to keep the holdover leases at $250 a month to the city.
I don't know.
We spent $85 million building this pyramid. First off, the $85 million was allocated to build a pyramid that was the same size as the ancient Cheops or Khufu pyramid in Memphis, Egypt. But the crooked stuff occurred, and the people that did what they did, they got the city to build the pyramid half size for the same price in a lot that's 7 feet below the river level. And it was acoustically ridiculous in that place. So a bunch of folk went bankrupt, but the usual suspects got their $85 million. Now, what did they do with the $85 million structure? They gave it to Bass Pro, which has one of the worst EEO records in the United States. And you know how much?
No, I'm scared to ask.
They pay $1
a
year.
Wow.
And
oh,
the city does the upkeep, the maintenance, provides the security, and the liability coverage. I'll tell you how they operate.
Oh,
okay, there was a development. And the person that was the developer wanted to get out from under the burden of the state and the local laws that said when you are a developer, if you have over a certain population density, each street has to have a minimum width, and you have to donate your own land to build these roads, and you have to build the roads out of your own pocket. Well, he didn't want to do that. So he wanted the city of Memphis to exercise eminent domain, pay him for the loss of use of the land area that would be devoted to the roads, and have the city build the roads. So what did he do? Well, he agreed to purchase a corner with a stop sign on it for $13,600. This has been 35 years ago. So he buys that corner for $1,600. Quietly, 3 months later, with nobody looking, the city bought it back from him for $6.8 million. That $6.8 million in tax funds was used by the developers to bribe the city council who voted for it.
Oh, my goodness.
See, that's how Memphis rolls. It's always been crooked. But this is the 21st century. And if you talk to a lot of the black elected officials, they say, well, it's our turn to get the gravy. No, it's not. It's not your turn to be a crook. It's your turn to do what you're supposed to, represent the interests of this people. This should be the mecca for black people, because it is essentially the largest predominantly black city in the USA.
Yes, I agree. We have homeless people, which is sad. It's really sad. And not only are they regular homeless people, but we also have soldiers that fought in wars and everything, that they're homeless and they're on the streets. What would you do in Memphis to make a change to that?
Put them to work.
Well, what about if they're up in age?
Well, then you do something about that. But you see, here's the deal. You're committing to $750 million to convert a football stadium into a soccer arena. And you're committing another several billion to build a new football stadium. Let's take care first things first. That money could be used to deal with people who are put to work cleaning up the city, because the city has gotten filthy. This used to win award after award for being the cleanest city in America. It's trash all over the place. You can put people to work, you see, but we don't do that. What are you going to do with the homeless? Part of the problem with the homeless is the same reason we have such a high penitentiary population. That's America's dirty little secret. The criminal justice system is operating on the same theory as to why we have homeless. It is not designed to stop crime. It actually encourages it, because the problem with the United States is we're the only industrialized country in the whole world that has no program to deal with obsolete workers, laborers, so that they will no longer be obsolete. We're supposed to leave it to private enterprise, and private enterprise is not into the business of non-profitable charity. It's into the business of making profit. So labor is a commodity like wheat, corn, rye, beef, pork, poultry. When you have a glut in a commodity market, what do? You cut through three things. You store the surplus. Well, no, let's start at the top. You cut back production. You subsidize the producer, and you store the surplus. we store our surplus in the jail cell or outliving, barely subsisting in the streets. The subsidy is the public assistance check if it's available. The cutting back of production is simply excluding them from the job market if they have viable employment skills like being a veteran or they have the equity, or most insidiously with the hip-hop and the rap and the glorification of dysfunction over the last 50 years, the kids bang out, drug out, drop out, get knocked up too early, too often, develop inappropriate attitudes, outlooks on life, ways of carrying themselves, ways of dressing. They don't have appropriate vocational skills. They don't have academic foundations, and they behave in a chaotic fashion that causes their respective communities to behave or be areas of chaos, so those communities cannot act in a cohesive fashion for political self-help on a collective basis. So soon enough, they wind up in the penitentiary, they get the felony conviction, and they're no longer employed. You get the people out on the streets, they get so demoralized that they don't become part of the job market either, so nobody does anything about putting them to work. See, I was in private practice when I first started seeing this homeless stuff in 1981. That was not America. It happened in a few months after it happened in California. What's the commonality? The Reagan administration. Now, he has his good points and his bad points, but that thing about, nuh-uh. See, I remember one time I got furious in 1980-something, 84. I looked at my tax return, and I was studying stuff, and I found that Boeing Aircraft paid fewer taxes in American dollars, not percentage-wise, but literally less tax than I did. How are you supposed to support the government? How are you supposed to support the country? And the biggest earners.
Still the case today.
Yes, but the party that supports it has flipped. Not to Republicans now. It's the Democratic Party. Clinton got high finance behind the Democrats. And Goldman Sachs seems to be the contributing factor. It looks like if you look at the last four Supreme Court nominees, outside of Trump, if you look at the three that Obama proposed and the one that Biden came up with, they all have Goldman Sachs connections. So does Barack Obama, so does Michelle Obama. The Attorney General of the United States worked with a law firm that represented Goldman Sachs. So what are you doing here? See, Goldman Sachs is in a unique position. Ordinarily, American banking law requires that all of a lending institution's accounts be backed up by a certain percentage of cash. That's what I was talking about when I was discussing changing the deposit schemes of the city. But Goldman Sachs was exempt. Geithner, who was their chief lobbyist and consultant, came up with the idea. You see, Target, Walmart, Walgreens, they wanted to get away from having to prosecute people for writing bad checks. So they wanted to set up ATM cards, check cashing cards, under the guise of them being restricted credit cards. So as a banking institution to do that, you would have to have accounts in which you had deposits. So Congress exempted Walmart, Target, et cetera, from having to back up their accounts. So when Geithner gets in, he got the same exemption for Goldman Sachs. That was before he became Treasury Secretary. And I find it interesting, I testified at the trial for Wesley Snipes, who was convicted not of evasion, but guess what he was convicted of? failure to file.
Oh, man, I remember that. Yeah.
Failure.
Because they owed him
Hold on. He didn't know. Not only did he not owe anything, IRS had a refund check for $250,000 for him overpaying taxes. So
yes.
Geithner, not 6 months prior to that, 9 months prior to that, pled guilty to tax evasion, $28 million worth of tax evasion. Remember, Wesley Snipes overpaid his taxes by $250,000, and he got found guilty for the minor misdemeanors of failure to file a complete set of returns. He got 3 years in a federal penitentiary. Geithner, for defrauding the government for tax evasion for $28 million, got 6 months probation and $42,000 in fines.
Huh. And that's something.
See the difference? Yeah.
Yes.
See, that kind of corruption is what's been going on and why we have homeless people. We don't have enough jobs to go around. So when people are homeless, you just leave them to suffer out in the street. When people have a background that is causing them to develop ideations that lead to dysfunction, because what they get is a constant barrage of dysfunctional propaganda, they take themselves out of the job market. Clown. And by the way, one of the driving engines that promotes a lot of police citizen violence, white and black, is because the kids don't know how to deal with people anymore. If you watch them, you say, wow, does this guy realize his bottom body language is saying to the other guy, I'm going to whip your behind, and, like, it's about to go down right now. And, like, you don't expect this guy's body language to ramp up in response. What the devil? Stop. I've jumped in and stopped some hostile situations because the people didn't even know what they were doing. You run into people that say, I'm not photogenic, and they look like reasonably attractive people. Well, the reason they aren't photogenic is because there's a thing called body language, and their body language is sending a very negative communication at the time the picture is taken. If I'm talking to you face-to-face, only 15% of what I'm saying to you consists of the words, 35% consists of the tone of voice, and 50% of the body language. So here are two people face-to-face in the voice and the body language. 85% of the message is there's about to be hostility. Well, yeah, that's what's going to happen. So people need to learn how to diffuse that. But nobody gets taught. So we need some adjustment. But no, the homeless people are getting a raw deal. It is absolutely disgusting to see what you see out there where these people are just thrown out in the streets. It's absolutely disgusting to see that these people have a pipeline from schoolhouse to jailhouse because there's surplus to labor requirements. And you know why they are? Because some people understand what their situations are, and they will not tolerate that, and they get angry, and they buy $250 worth of fertilizer. Ammonium nitrate, the most common fertilizer in America. It also makes a very effective high explosive, and they go down to Oklahoma City and they blow up a courthouse in Oklahoma City, and their last name is McVeigh. See, you don't want that.
No.
You keep them out of
not.
The way by exploiting circumstance. So you have people that are effectively left out on the streets with nobody giving a damn about it, or in the penitentiary where they're put to warehouse.
Yeah, that's not good.
No.
No, it's not.
So when is somebody going to do something about it? Well, first off, you have to recognize what you're looking at so you can take some curative action.
Yes.
We don't have a bad problem in Memphis. The weather is so strange and it rains so much, it's not really a place for homeless. There are not
that's
a lot of
good.
Places. So the population tends to sustain itself either through hustle that is a good hustle or hustle that is a bad hustle. And unfortunately, living off of somebody who's got a check.
Yeah.
It's unfortunate, but that can be reversed.
Yeah. Yes, it can. So I have to ask you, do you have any plans for that?
Yeah, I have plans for it. They work, too. They actually work. But when I left the bench, when I retired, that's been 23 years ago, I had thought that it would be carried on, but it required a lot of time and attention and effort by the people that would have been nominally over it, and they just don't exist anymore. It's all about money. I'm not getting paid extra for that. I'm not staying around to do that. So they go home to their dinner, or they go to the golf course, or they go hang out at the cocktail hour, or they go to the opera, or whatever in the hell they do. And things get neglected. Plus, you get people in positions now who don't really know what they're doing. You get partners in major law firms who maybe had 15, 20 trials in their entire career, if that, and junior partners who never had a trial, but they may have argued two motions, whereas 40 years ago, 35 years ago, 50 years ago, the senior partners had had hundreds of trials, and they had dealt with persuading people. They had real people across the desk from them who were live humans, and they had some commitment to law as a profession, not just a business. Now we have a lot of people who shouldn't really be advertising, but they do. They have a lot of clients, but they're like doctors who've gone to medical school but never done an internship or a residency and don't have the hands-on experience that's needed to really learn how to practice medicine. Well, you've got a lot of lawyers now who don't have the hands-on experience of dealing with 12 tried and true in a jury box, and they never learned how to practice law or what law was about. So a lot is neglected. But that's across the board. Everybody wants what they wanted. Nobody gets a first, second, or third place trophy. Everybody gets a participation ribbon.
Yeah. Yes, and that's exactly how it is. Yes.
Yeah.
You know, with these children, with sports and everything, they get a trophy for just participating.
No, but life's not like that.
No, it's not.
I have a right to be safe, you do. What about tornadoes, lightning strikes, volcanoes, earthquakes? Oh, wow. Okay, all of those can get you in the United States. Then you have typhoons, you have hurricanes, you have tsunamis, you have meteorites. You've got all kinds of things that can kill you. You've got diseases, so how do you say you have a right to be safe when you live on the planet Earth? You have a right to further your situation, but, you know, you owe something to everybody else because this is a collective. What are you doing to make it okay for everybody else?
Yeah. And that's a good question because what is being done? So to motivate people, especially these young children, how do you say that they will be motivated?
You give them a cause. They thirst for a cause. They want meaning to life. When you have a cause and a purpose, your life has meaning. Yo, Judge, you know, what's the point, man? I'm going to be dead before I'm 24, man, no later than 25. Well, then you make a good hero since you're already a dead man. You don't mind sacrificing yourself. Plus, you have a duty and responsibility to others. You have no daylight at the end of your tunnel. You can't see it because of the smoke and flames, and it's your job to kill off the fire-breathing Gila monsters that are doing that. So the people you have an obligation to can get to the end of the tunnel and you'll be remembered as a hero rather than a nothing.
Yeah. Hmm? Yes, that is true. That is definitely true.
Now
I have a question
to
ask you that's off base. Okay, go ahead. I'm sorry.
Go ahead. No, I'm yielding to you. Go ahead.
I was just going to ask you what made you decide to become a judge? I remember you saying before when you were on the show that being a lawyer was not something that you intended to do. You wanted to be a doctor. Is that something
mm-hmm.
that you regret? Do you regret not becoming a doctor?
Hey, that's a futile regret. It's way too late to do anything about it now. So I did what I could, but it wasn't really about a profession that I looked at as something to earn money. It's kind of like being a preacher. Are you there to make money so you can get a big car, fine suit, fine home, fine wife, dresser and coats and take vacations and lord it over everybody financially, or are you there to save souls? Question. I got raised to be about being a leader of your people, of people. That's what I've always tried to do. So, as a matter of fact, how did I become a judge? I got asked. I kind of got recruited. You know, with what you're doing and what you've seen in your perspective and the way you carry yourself, you ought to be a judge. I said, well, okay, fine, I will. I did. That TV show, I didn't apply for it. I didn't audition for it. They came to recruit me.
Well, that's
good. For 15 years, I wound up not the number two court show. I wound up the number two syndicated show overall. And I was beating Judy. We were all in the same CBS unit. It was me, Judy, Oprah, in that order. Dr. Phil, Judy, every time I started beating her, CBS would change her rating schedule because they didn't want a straight black man as being the number one TV show.
Yeah.
So
and they are
I
pushing
beat
that.
Yeah.
Oh, wow,
like
that's damn a lot to beat Oprah back then.
Well, yeah, I beat her every week the last several years. I beat Phil every day. Sometimes Oprah would beat me if she had something really controversial going on one day, but I beat her in the week's ratings all the time. Viacom said, CBS said I was their number one money-making show, lowest overhead and highest profit margin. But you never heard that because they did not want it to be. So after a while, I said, I've done this 15 years, I'm over retirement age, I quit. Bye.
Well, we miss you being on the air, Judge Joe. We miss the show.
I do this kind of stuff all the time. And what I'm giving you is the result of a half century of dealing with people's problems. And I've learned that often the reason they had those problems is because they took the pop culture view of what they were doing rather than the reality of what they were doing. Sometimes I could help them. Sometimes I couldn't. Sometimes I could feel almost sorry for them, and I watched them cry and lament the horrible things that had happened to them. Sometimes I couldn't even commiserate that way because they'd already been buried or cremated.
Oh, my. Oh, my goodness.
I've dealt with some pretty horrible people.
Yeah, I can imagine.
Oh, I mean some really vicious people. There was one guy represented, was part of the defense team. He liked to tie his victims up and peel their eyelids back from their eyeballs so they couldn't close their eyes and wet their eyes as he peeled strips of skin from them.
Ew.
I represented part of the defense team. Somebody will advise the defense team. Somebody they call Dracula. He was preying on female personnel out at Militia Naval Air Station. He'd go out in the woods surrounding the area, find a young pine tree sapling, bend it over with rope and tackle, strip the branches off the top, kidnap a woman, strip her, torture her, drug her, rape her, and then while she's tied up and semi-conscious, he would insert the top of the tree in her vaginal canal and then release the tree so she would be impaled, and it would take hours for the tip of the tree to slide up through her insides and come out next to her neck.
Behind
the clap or in through their throat to penetrate the brain. Yeah, that's some horrible people.
Yes, oh my God. And just so that, oh Lord, let's talk about something else. You recently
you ought to see being on the bench, and you've got to review the evidence, and the state wants to get an item of clothing admitted, and it's covered with dead maggots and crusted, foul-smelling, rotted, sour blood.
I don't know.
Oh, that's really nice for your lunchtime appetite.
Oh, Lord. Oh, my.
Or,
I don't know how you did it, but you did it.
Or how about
goodness.
This one? Mr. Duckett, would you please escort the jury back to the jury room? Yes, sir. Doctor, you testified that the victim got shot in the head twice. Well, yes, sir, that's correct. Why is the court looking at three identical bullets in several of these x-rays in the victim's skull? Three, not two. Let me see that. Oh, my God, there are three bullets. So how do you explain
that?
You talk about there were two holes in this man's skull. Well, they must have had two bullets through the same hole. Two 25 caliber bullets through the same bullet hole? Doctor. And it wasn't a contact shot you testified to. This person, that kind of fluke? See, you get all kinds of crazy stuff. Well, you take courses on autopsy and forensics, and you study gunshot residue on bare flesh and how far back somebody's got to be before that's no longer apparent. Or how many generations of maggots to be found in a body indicate how long that body's been a body, and you got to correlate them with the weather conditions. Or you walk in the medical examiner's building and you can smell the foul odor of a rotten body that's being autopsied. Oh, that's real nice.
Oh. Oh, my. Oh, my goodness.
Yeah.
Oh, Lord. Okay. We did a mock trial of Hunter Biden where you found him
three
guilty.
Three laptops. Well, they didn't find him guilty. That wasn't the objective. The objective was to determine if there was probable cause to believe that further criminal investigations should be necessary. That's what grand juries do. It's not a finding of guilt. The person is presumed innocent until proven guilty beyond a reasonable doubt. That's the Constitution. But what happened is they had in there the technician who examined the three laptops. He showed the proof he had about getting authorized to extract what was in them. Three, not two, they suffered from liquid damage. And some of the stuff that was in there, the transcriptions from the emails, for example, we That is myself and the lawyer who was representing the hypothetical defense, one that was a hypothetical prosecutor. We advised Fox, but you don't show that. That stuff compromises security. It'll get somebody. So what we were looking at is whether there was a FARA violation, F-A-R-A, FARA, Foreign Agents Registration Act violation. And the question came down to, why would you pay somebody $84,000 a month without including the bonuses in that total for essentially a crackhead drug addict who had no business background, who had been recently at the time discharged from the armed services for drug addiction, who had not availed himself of the rehab programs that were freely available. And when you looked at the laptops, it was clear that he was being paid that for access to his father, the vice president, who was listed as the big guy. And there were back and forth discussions about that on the laptop. There were White House tapes in there, and we didn't even consider the porn stuff. Apparently Hunter thought he was a porn producer and a porn star, so there was a lot of that salacious stuff in there. But aside from that, there was some really bad stuff in there. And then you get into that thing, too, that we touched on when we were doing the investigation about the documents that were found in the Largo. Now, Trump was president of the United States at the time, and under the case of U.S. Department of the Navy versus Egan, and reading some of the majority opinions in that case, essentially, under the Constitution, as commander-in-chief of the military and chief diplomatic officer of the United States, the president may classify or declassify any document he chooses in any fashion he chooses. So the argument would be that the documents in the Largo, he declassified, he's got the authority to do it, and since he was privy to what was in them and they were prepared for his benefit, let's say he's got a photographic memory, it's not going away. So you look at Hunter Biden and his relationship to Joe Biden. At the time, Joe Biden was the vice president, and he didn't have that authority to declassify anything under the Constitution. And the question raises itself, did those declassified documents in the non-release logs of visitors have anything to do with what we were reading in the email exchanges on those laptops with foreign agents? So it was not pleasant. One of the people that had a career as a Manhattan district attorney prosecutor, so had the other one, and both of them had been in private practice as defense lawyers for a long time. So they were quite upstanding, very good lawyers. And we all looked at each other and said, oh, this is some deep stuff. This should not be. Yeah, I was.
Well, Judge, would you like to open it up and see if anyone has any questions or comments for you?
Sure. We've been on, let's see, 2 hours and 40 minutes, 37 anyway. Let's take a comment or two. We can do that.
Okay. Anyone, if you have a question or a comment? Or if you press the number one, I'll be happy to open your line. Okay. Well, I guess everybody doesn't have anything to say. I think you must have devastated them talking about the courts and what you see and everything.
Or else I put them to sleep, but, you know, I could have told some
No, you didn't. You have a caller now, Judge Joe.
See,
hey, code 706.
Yes. Good evening, Sister Antoinette, and good evening, Judge Joe Brown.
Good evening, Brother Kwame.
Yes. thankful for all that you've shared and the information as to how you would restructure Memphis and the city government. What we're looking at as part of what's going on in Jackson and the HB 1020, how do you see that if that was the case that was in Memphis?
Well, it already is the case in Memphis. Long been. We have six and county courts here. We have a juvenile court that is a amalgam of city court and county court. And we have the state courts with appellate jurisdiction over the county courts. So what you have in Jackson is a situation where, as I understand it, your governor is going to appoint the incumbents for 4 years' worth of term. I do not know whether they will be standing for election after that, because it seems to me that the rest of your Mississippi judges are electable. And it looks like what you have is either a suburb that is designated as a municipality where they would have jurisdiction limited to that suburb. And perhaps that suburb could vote for them. But if they had a bigger jurisdiction over the rest of the area for metropolitan Jackson, then you've got another situation. Now, this is when your young lawyers ought to be coming to the fore and volunteering to take the matter up on appeal, because it's their civic duty to do so. Hopefully you will have some that are not driven just by money interests, but will do what they should do. The Mississippi courts can resolve that, and also it is a political matter. You see, Mississippi is not without its black representatives, and you might want to question them on why that came about and what steps they took to see that it did no harm. Now, I think, well, I'm not going to tell anybody about out of practice law or whatever, but we had a situation like that in Memphis. And there was one judge that represented that. So it's been 45 years ago. I thought it was wrong how he got in, that he did not represent the requirements to handle such things on a statewide basis. So I had a client. I was running the public defender's office. So I picked one of the public defender's clients and handled the appeal. And I said it was a matter of equal protection. Anybody in the state charged with such and such offense would have benefit of a judge selected by that met the following qualifications. This did not. So I based the habeas corpus on whether he was competent. And I took a unique way of handling it that most of the lawyers would have never thought about in the local area. It prevailed. It went up on appeal, and the appellate court sustained what the local state judge had done, which was they agreed that he was incompetent, so he couldn't hear any more criminal cases for his career. So there are ways of doing things like that. But the details elude me 45 years ago.
Okay, and thank you for that, because I'm trying to get the understanding that, like you were saying earlier about the female judges there in Memphis and the percentage of female judges, and then you have, you know, each state has a Supreme Court, and that's a... Isn't the judge on those Supreme Courts appointed by the governor, and the elected judges are the judges that are voted in the city municipalities?
Well, I can't speak for Mississippi, but in Tennessee, the governor appoints somebody to fill a vacancy. They have to stand at the next regular election, but they stand under the modified Missouri plan, which means that there is shall we retain or replace. So there is no active opponent. If the majority of the voters say replace, then there will be an active opponent. That's at the top. And then the next level, you have people who are running for retention. And if they are not retained, then that makes it a live seat. Then you get to the entry trial level courts where they handle jury trials and unlimited jurisdiction before you get to the appellate level. Those judgeships are elected. The governor would appoint people to fill vacancies, but they have to stand at the next regularly scheduled election. I'm not exactly sure what the situation is in Mississippi, but the last I checked, it was something similar. So you might want to check. And like I said, motivate some of your young who are 4, 5, 6 years out of law school who want to take on a giant and play David to Goliath and make a name for themselves and build up a future track record. By the way, when you're looking for an attorney, first thing you do when you have an accident case or something it wants to deal with, you ask that lawyer how many cases he's tried, jury trials. There are people on the national level who not seem to have had any jury trials, but they're getting a great deal of notoriety. They may or may not be good trial lawyers. I don't know because nobody's seen them, but you might want to inquire whether somebody is going on rep that is just PR or rep from performance.
Okay. And you're running for mayor, and the mayor of Mississippi is the son of Chokwe Lumumba Sr. He's Chokwe Lumumba Jr. And Sr. was the one who founded the Republic of New Africa. And the part about that was their struggle was to get in reparations Louisiana, Mississippi, Alabama, Georgia, and South Carolina. They wanted the five states or the southern states. That was their appeal for their reparations and that movement. But with him being the son of Chokwe and the radical things in which he stood for, I'm looking at the Dixiecrats are looking at how to get back at, you know, him representing and him having the same vision that his father had.
Well, I don't know. I grew up in an area, finished law school, where the radicalism was embraced by the Black Student Alliance, Black Student Unions, Black Panther Party. And our thing was somewhat different. When it comes to reparations, my maternal grandfather, who was born in 1850, he always tried to push reparations, and he always got worked up about where is the 40 acres and a mule, because I think he was 15 when General Sherman issued that edict in January 1865 saying that all slave families were to get 40 acres of confiscated rebel land and one army mule. I know my paternal grandfather, who was a preacher starting in 1896 up in St. Louis, Kojic up there from Memphis, from Bishop Mason, one of his first disciples, he was for reparation. And I know my parents were all trying to deal with reparations in one sense or another. My father was born in 1910, and my mother was born in 1917. And I know three times in my life we've talked about it. It has gone from they need to give us land back to that, to cash me out, to benefits, to all kinds of other things. And it hasn't happened yet. So we'll see where it goes. I would like it, but you know, I'd like to win the big lottery too, but I'll buy tickets to the damn thing, the big one.
Yeah.
However,
we have another caller.
Thanks, Judge.
I'm sorry. Thank you, Brother Kwame. Judge, Joe, we have another caller for you. Area code 601. Wait a minute, they were there. Are they still here? Oh, they dropped. Sorry. Area code 601, if you change your mind, just put your hand back up and I'll let you in. Okay, here they are. Okay, area code 601. If you have yourself on mute, take yourself off. Hello? Okay. If anybody else has a question or a comment, press the number one, and I'll let you in. Area code 601, I'm going to put you back on mute. Okay, now they got their hand back up. Okay, let's see. Area code 601. If you're saying something, we can't hear you.
Unmute. Unmute yourself.
Ah, okay, I found it. I'm sorry. I had hidden the mute key. This is Ia Falolo Mabola from Jackson, in Jackson, Mississippi. And I appreciate everything that has been said this evening. What I will say is that I came here originally due to Shokwe Sr., may he rest in peace, and ended up I didn't come here for that, but I stayed here because of him. And I ended up working with him on his media. I was the media coordinator for his campaign and worked with him very closely. As a result, I came to know his children very well, Antar, Shokwe Antar Lumumba and Rekia Lumumba. I hear what you're saying about trepidation about what is happening as far as Antar is concerned, but I would say without a doubt that he is not turning his back on the work that his father has done. He may be.
I didn't say that.
Okay.
I didn't say anything about it. I just said I don't know him.
I got the assumption.
What I said was I was unfamiliar with what his father was doing because at the time that I was concerned about these things dealing with reparative efforts, I thought in terms of West Coast, Black Panther Party, Black Student Alliance, Black Student Union type stuff. That's what I said.
Okay, well, I apologize because that's not the impression that I got, so I'll retract my statement.
I mean, I'm sure he did great work. I just can't talk on it because I'm not that familiar with it.
All right.
313. Ms. Kim?
Blessing. Yes, blessing. Bless you, Brother Judge Brown. How are you doing?
All right, ma'am.
Good, good. This is Kim Weston, and there were some people that I had mentioned to Antoinette. I wanted to know, do you know them, or are you familiar with Dina Parker, Betty Crutcher? These are people that I worked with when I was there with Stax Records.
The name sounds familiar.
Okay, but you don't know them.
When did you leave?
I was with Stax just before the crash.
Well, I've been here since 1973, so if you left before that, I might not know you.
This is
or
Kim
know
Weston.
Them.
You know Kim Weston.
That name sounds familiar.
Okay.
Oh, that's a joke.
Did you know Helen, did you by any chance know Helen Washington?
Yes, mm-hmm. Not well, but I knew her. Mm-hmm. I met her.
She was a tenant. She was a friend and wound up a tenant of mine. Now, if there's a connection between her and the rest of them, yeah, I'd probably know them. Isaac Hayes and such like.
Yeah, these are the people that work with Isaac.
Yeah. Well, I might know them through Isaac and Helen.
I was just thinking that they would be good people. They're good people for you to have on your team.
Well, I think I'll take a look and see if I can contact them. My niece, who is my, I guess it would be chief of staff. She used to manage Isaac's restaurant down there in Peabody Place for him. So she's acquainted with that, everybody. And her uncle was Mitchell. You know, they've got that recording studio not far from where the Stax Academy is.
Well, then she would know Betty Kletcher and Dina Parker.
Okay.
She would know them.
All right. Well, thank you for that suggestion.
As well as the Funk brother, and I can't think of his name right now. He's the last Funk brother that's living, original Funk. But well, he's not an original. He's in the second phase. Oh my goodness.
Okay. Let me ask. That's Ms. Crutcher. What's her first name?
Betty. Betty Crutcher and Dina Parker. And there's some other people I've been trying to think of. It's been a good one.
That's Lena Parker?
Dina. D-E-A-N-A. They were official with Stax, so that's why I'm saying, you know.
Okay, I'll see that somebody gets with them. Thank you.
I'm going to have to tell Antoinette the young man's name. I gave it to her, but I know she don't remember right now. But I'll think of it.
No, I'm sorry, I don't.
That's why
I'm sorry,
Ms.
Kim.
I didn't bother you.
No, ma'am, you didn't.
Yes, ma'am.
Lady. You want to tell everyone how they can get your barbecue sauce?
Oh, yeah. Okay. In addition, going to my website, jjb2023.com, that's for services, mayor, that's service. You can get sauce. I've got a pretty doggone good barbecue sauce and seasoning and other products. It's at jjbbbq.com, Judge Joe Brown Barbecue. And we have the powder coming out, the sauce coming out. Well, we got the sauce out. You can order it online. I would suggest the 3-pack. That's most economical when it comes to shipping. You can get more or less. We have smoked chicken links, raw chicken links, hot and mild, and they're packed by a sister who runs the only USDA-certified black-owned packing plant in California. And also we are collaborating with a sister named Michelle Dukes, whose father and grandfather are from Mississippi, and they were moonshiners, and she is using their formula for whiskey, and she's the only black-run distillery in America, and it's run by a sister, Michelle Dukes, and the name of the whiskey, the bourbon, is Poppies, P-A-P-I apostrophe S. It is some smooth bourbon, and to me it's better than Jack Daniels. Blanton's or Booker's or Bullet is on that level. It's some smooth stuff. Goes down like water if you like bourbon. So check us out. We're on the shelves in L.A. Well, in California, we're spreading east. We are way ahead of the curve, so got some new investors. It ought to be good. Try it. JJBBQ.com, and it's been winning a lot of blind taste tests.
And that's good. That's really good.
Excuse me, Antoinette. Jack Ashford.
Yes, ma'am.
Jack Ashford is one of the Funk Brothers.
Oh, okay. That's who you said the Judge Joe needs to get in contact with.
Jack Ashford, Betty Crusher, and Dina Parker.
Yes. Jack Ashford.
You got that?
Jack Ashford, and I'm sure your niece knows all three of them.
You know, I'm getting sick of this iPhone right now. Every time I type this, it's trying to go Ash, separate word, fall. And when I was trying to type in Betty Crutcher, it was trying to put in, it's Crutcher, right?
Crutcher, uh-huh.
Okay, kept trying to limit that to crutch. Big crutch. I don't know.
That must be an Android.
No, it's an iPhone. Sometimes it develops a mind of its own, and its AI gets to acting up.
Yeah.
Mm.
One other thing I wanted to tell you about judges. I worked under Mayor Young for 20 years, and for 17 of those years, I had a summer youth program in the performing arts, which they said would never work, but it worked for 17 years until the mayor retired. And I'd like to tell you about that sometime, okay? So, for your young people.
Yeah, I want to set that up. We've got a lot of talent locally, and I have some Hollywood connections, so I want to set something up so we develop that.
I tell you this, some of the young people that work with me, Lisa McCall has her own dance company. She was Lisa's choreographer for the last years. Lisa came to me when she was 10 as a young man named Kern Bradley. He worked for Beyonce and Lady Gaga, and they took the techniques from the program. And that's what they're using in their profession. Just to name a couple of them.
Okay, well, yeah, that's something that would work. That's on my agenda anyway, to bring in something that would galvanize the talent that's here. What produced Stacks is still here. Basically, most of what's coming out of this now is rap.
And you have the professionals there that could pass it on to the kids the right way.
Right, so... There's a movie industry, there's opportunity for writers, real writers, who want to put in the time to do what's necessary to really be able to write. The television industry wants to get in here. The only thing they want to do seems like is put in street racing and that kind of thing. But we can do something. There are trying to deal with what they can get under the table, but I don't think these folks should be subjected to that. But we've got some people talking about putting in a black production studio to deal with the movie television industry.
That's good. If anybody else has a question or comment, if you press number one, I'll let you in. Closing.
Mm-hmm.
What do you have prepared for the black community?
Whoa, I just spent an hour and a half telling you that. 2 hours.
Well, give us what you got.
Well, I just ran it down for 2 hours. Where do you want me to start? I've got a comprehensive program about bringing jobs into the area, restructuring the police department under civilian command and control, making the city honest, holding people accountable for the money that they have gotten that belong to the taxpayers, to bringing in trade and improving export opportunities, improving the industrial posture, developing a novel method to produce energy cheaply. It would be green. And also mm-hmm. sell that energy for profit to surrounding municipalities all up and down and way away from the river and set up a nascent industry dealing with that type of energy production that could be the equivalent for the 21st century of the last one when they had the dot-com revolution out in Silicon Valley. So there are a lot of things here about getting the youth to have a purpose and a cause, organizing the people to help patrol their own neighborhoods in collaboration with the police, some things about solidifying the relationship between the community and the police, since the police department is actually 65% black. That yes. ought to be something somebody ought to quickly look into. And a great number of the police from Memphis are from this area, so they have community connections, but nobody seems to be interested in that. So we've got a plan. Now, you want me to go into it more deeply before I put anybody to sleep again?
No, you didn't put anyone to sleep.
Just answer that.
Everyone was listening to you. Yes, yeah, somebody just called my name.
Yeah, I wanted to ask Judge Joe Brown one other thing about what the future of Memphis is looking at. In the restructuring of America, they're looking at rail as the transportation hub and looking at Memphis by way of the Mississippi by bringing up containers and transporting them up to Mississippi and then transport a distribution hub, because that's part of why that connection with the old 78 turned into 22 as an interstate. And do you see this as what happened, like Federal Express came there when Fred Smith made that the hub? And UPS did their hub in Kentucky. The rail transportation is the future of what America's economic commodities will be moved around the country in. So how do you see Memphis right now as coming mayor and the restructuring, especially coming off of 22, and I go through there quite often, that whole rail system they have and unloading those trailers and the trucking lanes that go through there. How do you see restructuring that someone says that interstate is going to turn to rail and this is how the country is going to be running. How do you see it?
Well, that interstate highway system is known as the National Defense Highway System. It was designed by Eisenhower in the 30s, and it's set up to strategically link up certain areas that are of tactical concern in the event that there is an actual physical invasion of the territory. That said, I doubt that you will get rid of the defense highways, and they also provide a means of tactical control of cities. I saw that in 1965 when we had our uprising, what the National Guard did when it came in and used them. Now, that aside, if they modify some of these barges to handle containers that you get nominally shipped from Europe to the East Coast by container ships, yes, But there is a drive in Europe to do something different. They have standardized containers, which are not the ones that you are used to seeing on rail cars. They can be used in trucks, planes, trains, and barges. So in Europe, what they do is they load these barges up on the canals and waterways, and they float them down to the Mediterranean, or they go up to the Baltic up north, and they put them on board ocean-going barge transports. They take those transports, they wind up Port of New Orleans, they drop the rear hatches, they float the barges up to President's Island in Memphis, which is the world's largest barge unloading facility. They're 4.6 miles from the center of the distribution hub of the United States, Canada, and Mexico. By geography, this is where the Tennessee Valley crosses the Mississippi River, and that since ancient times, there's been a lot of commerce moving through here. Right now, if you use rail traffic, you have to run most of what you get north and east to get to the East Coast, when it is so much easier to transport the stuff by water rather than wasting time on trains. So you load the barges up here, take them to Europe. But you also receive the barge traffic coming from Europe. And when you send this stuff, for instance, the cars back to Europe, you don't just stop in the Mediterranean. You go through it. You go through the Suez Canal. And when you get through the Suez Canal, you get into Asia. So you can distribute the Ford electric cars, the Cadillac electric cars that will be made very near to Memphis. When you get over there, you've got the empty traffic, and what you do is you load them up with Hondas, Toyotas, Mitsubishis, Lexus vehicles, Infinities, and such like, and you go back through the Suez Canal, through the Mediterranean, you dock again in New Orleans, send this stuff up to Memphis, and now you save the Asian shippers 9,000 miles off of the route they would usually take going to Los Angeles Harbor, which is Long Beach, directly across the Pacific, and you are 2,000 miles closer to the distribution hub of America, which is Memphis. That's why FedEx, UPS now does most of their shipping, the bulk mail center, and all the American Grain Company, National Grain Company. And interestingly enough, with few exceptions over the last 30-some years, Memphis has had the highest commercial tonnage fly out of it or into it in the world. Second place by half is usually Hong Kong. One year out of the last three, Hong Kong actually jumped in front of Memphis, but ordinarily Memphis runs twice the commercial tonnage out of it that Hong Kong does. That's where we're located. Now, this generation of electricity, they have these modular hydroelectric generators, the bottom half of outboard motors. And you don't need concrete emplacements. You can get floats, you can get rafts, you can get a whole bunch of them, thousands of them, in a relatively small area. You can moor these floats, these platforms, and you take a device that's designed to go with tides that come in for 3 hours on one day, flow out four, and then it varies depending upon the day of the month. And you spend 7/8 of your expense on storage batteries, so to speak. But here you don't need storage batteries because the Mississippi River flows continuously 24/7, so you dump all of this into a power net. You sell the surplus from New Orleans to Louisville to Little Rock to Jackson, Mississippi to Nashville to Chicago, all points in between to Atlanta. It becomes part of an industry devoted to that. You get the experimental situation developed. Meanwhile, you've got electric cars that are going to be manufactured here Ford has indicated they will have 27,500 employees operating out of what they call Blue Oval City, which is now where Mason, Tennessee is. Mason, Tennessee has a population of 5,200 people. Now, that means that there's going to be a town of 150,000, 200,000 people built to deal with the families and the needs from fast food to barbershops to movie theaters to grocery stores to handle the people that will live in that area. A lot of folk are lining up trying to get rich quick without doing much good for the people, but that's got to stop, and the people have to be bought into the loop. Now, with that said, there is the energy, and in American history, when you analyze it, the manufacturing centers were located where the fuel was, not so much where the raw material was located. If they get almost cost-free energy available to them, you can bring in a lot of heavy industry, and that means that when they manufacture, they'll have to get outside of the immediate area to get to their markets. Now, somebody needs to come up with a plan to modify some of these barges so they're easy enough to run rail cars onto them with the containers that you see so profusely on container ships. That's a novel way of dealing with it and also of loading up these ocean-going barge transports. If you ever get to New Orleans, go down to the port, and you'll see these things that look like 1,000-foot-long streamline oil tankers. Those are ocean barge transports. So there is a lot of opportunity to get in with a lot of things here, and we could take advantage of it. And Jackson, Mississippi is in hailing distance, as is Vicksburg, Mississippi. So there's a lot that can be done. That's in the extra.
Thank you, Judge.
Thank you, Brother Kwame. We have another caller, area code 404.
Hey, Antoinette, Jug and the gang. Hey, Jug.
Hello, Brother Wesley.
Hey, Jug.
Hey, Brother Wesley.
Hey,
how you doing?
Yes, sir. Man. I'm good, Jug. You know, I know you, man. I know your brain, man. I got two questions for you. Dr. Claude Anderson, I'm going to send you his information because he wants to try to run a high-speed rail just for us going from, I think, South Carolina to Texas. So I'm going to send you his information. So maybe you can help him out, man, because that's his plan.
Well, let me tell you about that train. One of the problems with this whole area is you can get to Dallas easy enough, but how do you get to Houston? If you want to go to Houston, you have to go down through Jackson, Mississippi, down through New Orleans, and then go over. There's no direct route to get down there, which is a transportation net deficit. We need a high-speed rail, but one of the things that we need to do in terms of setting up a net is based on certain things that are going to happen. There should be a high-speed train as the seed installation in the system going from Memphis to Nashville, then to Knoxville, then to Chattanooga, dropping down into New Orleans. We need also one expanding off going from Memphis to Jackson, Mississippi. Jackson, Mississippi should have a feed line going into what goes down into New Orleans or going down into Houston. So I don't know why in the world they set up the interstate highway system where Houston is effectively isolated, because if you want to take the most direct route, it's the slowest one, and you have to go through 25 is the speed limit. Motorcycles not allowed in it. Towns all the way there.
Now, but he wanted to run parallel to Interstate 20. My second question, man, I'm futuristic, man. I know you, Judge. I want you to consider this, man. All right? You ever heard of cryogenic? I worked in a cryogenic building a machine.
Want to freeze somebody? Who is it you want to freeze and bring back?
you, man. You, when your time up, man, whatever you, I want you to get so you come back, man, in the future. Keep on running, bro. I'm serious, Judge. You just consider that.
You know, when I die, I plan on being too damn tired of this place to want to come back. I would have had my...
Well, you consider that, man. That's what I said, question. I know.
You know, that's like, wouldn't you, if you knowing what you, like, you know what, that's like one of these questions. Knowing what you know now, wouldn't you like to go back and relive your life? Hell no. There were too many tight ropes I almost fell off of. I don't want to do that.
Okay, good. I'll just start to consider, man. If I
but
then
again, going
back
to the far future, the devil, you know.
What's that baseball player? It's a baseball player that did it. I can't remember his name, man. What's that baseball player? What's that unusual? But anyway, Judge, that's beautiful, man. I would consider that to come back way in the future, man. But that's you, man. I love you, man. That's my two questions, man. I catch you on
all
the
right.
show tomorrow, man.
Yes,
okay,
sir.
Thank you. Thank you.
Well, we're going to have a treat tomorrow. Guess who have coming tomorrow? One of our guests is going to be the lady who is the widow of a Tuskegee Airman. And who is director of the Tuskegee Airmen's Association. Her name is Madam Dolores Brown. No relationship.
Mm-hmm.
Fine
right
lady.
Right up
well, I'm excited for that.
Tell Brother Ray, too.
Ms. Kim still on?
Yes, she's still here. Judge, you got to tell us where to hear that at.
Okay, I will. Valerie Denise Jones is the producer. So you can find me just like you do here. The number is 929-477-1167. 929-477-1167. And if you want to talk, press 1. Now, we will be going from 3 local time to 5, after which you can't call in. But if you're already online, we have what Val calls the Hunger Games, where all lines are open. And please be polite and respectful, but have at it.
Judge is looking at having a recognition. I know certain states, Alabama has it, honoring the Tuskegee Airmen because Billy Fauntleroy, who's Brother Ray. But he's also did this, and he was the star, the Black Caucus, Walter Fauntleroy. And so this is what she has been raising, you know, the awareness of having us to have in major cities to have Tuskegee Airmen Day and making this, you know, a day in which we recognize what they did, and even to the point that it would be an international, because a lot of Europe would not be, you know, they played a major part in protecting those bombers when they was in World War II. So we're looking at how do we, with Billy still alive and able to talk about what he was, because he was one of the youngest or the last of some of the Tuskegee Airmen. And, yes, they do have a lot of Tuskegee. Go ahead.
Ms. Brown knows them.
Right.
Tell you about the Tuskegee Airmen. Here's what we owe them. A lot of what happens in America happens because you get a lot of the youngest generation of grown folk imbued by what they get taught in the military. 1947, President Truman, with Executive Order 1981, backed up by Republican Prescott Bush, a U.S. Senator from Massachusetts, desegregated the armed services. One of the primary reasons he was able to do that is the Tuskegee Airmen at the first Red Flag fighter competition in 1946 and then again in 1947, and after he signed that 1981 order, in 1948, won the Red Flag Fighter Competition. It was held outside Reno, and interestingly enough, on neither of those 3 years were they permitted to go inside the casino and receive their awards. What happened was Truman said, you said these boys can't operate complex machinery, so how the devil did they manage to whip you white boys in this competition if they weren't good? Now, let's extrapolate on they had the 442nd composite group operating out of Detroit. It was almost exclusively a black unitary area and base. There were a few white officers, so they had a officers club that only white officers were permitted to go in, but all of the flyers involved were officers. So they had 8 or 9 times the number of black officers on that base than white ones. So the blacks committed a mutiny and insisted on going in, staged in a demonstration inside the white officers club. They decided to court-martial, so all of the future who's who, including Thurgood Marshall, got involved in defending them outside of Detroit, and it galvanized a lot of people to get up in arms, literally, about what was going on. Now, further, we know that the Tuskegee Airmen did not lose a single bomber under their protection in World War II that they were charged to escort. We know, since the Defense Department has released the information, that for the last 9 months of World War II in Europe, the Tuskegee Airmen were the high-scoring fighter unit. What we do not know is that after 1991, when the Luftwaffe records that were held in East Germany were made available to the West, and they started analyzing them through computer correlation, and the careful Luftwaffe records where Lieutenant so-and-so arrived in a badly damaged ME-109G, almost shot down, and you find that there's an American fighter pilot claiming to have shot that plane down, you discount his score. So after they have done the computer analysis, guess what? Captain Roscoe Brown of the Tuskegee Airmen is now listed as the second highest scoring American fighter ace in Europe in World War II, and he's got 2 pending, which if they verified by digging in the ground archaeologically, he becomes the number one highest scoring fighter pilot for the U.S. Army Air Corps in World War II in Europe. So you see, this whole script has been flipped. So we owe them a debt, and we owe them recognition as some badass brothers. And, oh, by the way, there's another little thing about what happened. The Tuskegee Airmen had the highest average score in the whole United States Army for the aptitude and qualifications test. They made them take the damn thing twice because they could not believe that colored folks scored higher than every single somebody in the Tuskegee Airmen when they got given the IQ and aptitude test would have been higher than everybody else in the U.S. Army. Now, that's interesting. And that needs to be recognized. So these are some outstanding brothers that open up a hell of a lot in politics, social advancement, job, and establishing a rep. We did what we did in basketball, football, and baseball.
Hey, Jim, in the real world. Dr. Claude Anderson website by this high speed rail, because he needs some help, man. He's trying to do this for us. He said that's the last thing he want to do for us, man. So I sent you his information, man. You can check it out. Maybe you can help him.
Yeah, well, I've talked with him before. I have no problem getting with him. One of these days I might write a book myself. In fact, I've been working on one or two or three of them. Maybe one day I'll finish them. But let me say this too. Claude Anderson is a smart man. He's wise, Dr. Anderson. And there are a number of black folk that I've been trying to talk into writing books. And there's a lot of wisdom out there. But before we all die, you need to listen to us. Some of us have been like Dr. Anderson and written our thoughts down, and some of them have not, and they speak them. So before we all die, take a listen in. You might learn something, because we've been there, seen that, done that, and we have some things to say to you. One question that I always get, what about black unity? I say it's good. Be careful who you unify with, because you may be associating yourself with traitors, pimps, simps, and hustlers who are an advantage by taking you down or thwarting your efforts to do something for the people. Be careful.
That's a sermon right there, dude. You smart. I love to listen to you, man. Good job, bro. I learned so much, man, to listen to you.
Your Honor.
Thank you. It's always a pleasure.
Your Honor, you were speaking about the 101 that were at Freeman Field. That's where the mutiny took place. But also, Mayor Young wrote, I don't know what you would call whatever he wrote, at when they were getting out, he wrote what was whatever they felt. I don't know what you would call that that speech at that time or whatever he wrote. And I want to find that.
You're talking about Mayor Andrew Young, Ambassador Young?
No, Coleman Young of Detroit.
Coleman. Okay, Detroit, yes. I
he
met him, but I can't. Or knew him.
He was a senator before he became mayor.
Yes.
But he was a Tuskegee Airman, and he was Obama.
I know, but I don't know him. You know what I'm saying? I've met him, but I don't know him. I had a long, interesting conversation over several hours with Roscoe Brown, Captain Roscoe Brown, Professor Emeritus Dr. Roscoe Brown, formerly of New York University. And I have talked over the years with other former Red Tail aviators. So they are an interesting lot. Matter of fact, I used secretary of Chappie James, who wound up four-star general over NORAD, North American Air Defense Command. It was interesting when I go to D.C. to visit her. Her sister was one of Jimmy Carter's, was teacher for one of Jimmy Carter's children. So they paid attention to the teacher's family, and my date was secretary for the command general of North American Air Defense. So anytime I flew in, the Secret Service was out there. And we didn't have to worry about parking. They let her park her car right there and guarded it. And she just walked in, got me, got the baggage, and they helped carry it out and put it in the vehicle. That's been a long time ago, but it sure was fun. That was back in the 70s. Damn, she sure was fine. But anyway, here's what it
is. You know you need to write that book 2 or 3, as you see it.
Just so, how can people donate to your campaign?
Okay,
so that we can get you in there.
Okay, if you go to my website, jjb2023.com, there are several methods of donating. If you have a Cash App, mine is $JudgeJoeBrown2023, $JudgeJoeBrown2023, and you can donate. Now, we are not taking contributions from the big-time folk. We're taking them from small people. We appreciate 5, 10, 20, 50, 100, whatever you can afford, but we don't want the big folks to jump in here necessarily, because unless they're ordinary people, we don't want any corporate donors.
Yes, well, that's good. So that way you don't have to worry about them controlling it.
They wouldn't anyway, but just avoid appearance of impropriety. And the other thing is that what I'm offering is an opportunity for the people to govern the city, put me in the office, and they can run the town through Joe Brown. Send Brown downtown and run your town.
That sounds good.
Yeah, I used to be in the entertainment in one sense at the time, even though I was doing contractual arbitration on TV, but I tried to make it amusing. Years ago, I learned that if you kept the jury awake by having a sense of humor and making it entertaining, they paid attention to what you had to say and fell asleep on the other guy. Ladies and gentlemen of the jury, yes, we have a situation here, but it was not my client, oh. No, not my thing.
John, I met you at the Whiskey A Go-Go.
Okay. You mean in L.A.?
Yes, sir. You were with Rita Payne, and I was there with the Miracles.
There you go. And you know Frida's sister, other Ms. Payne. Sherry with the Supremes.
The Supremes, uh-huh.
I still talk to them.
That's good.
You know, Frida and I dated for 8 years.
You were dating when I met you?
Oh, no. Yeah. She's a beautiful woman, still is.
Yes, let me make this announcement.
I remember you now. Yes, yes. Okay.
Yeah, I sent you a ham.
Let me make this announcement, y'all. Don't forget Dry Bones on Sunday for the Helios Delios at 10 a.m. Eastern Time. Don't forget Brother Ray at 3 p.m. Eastern Time, no matter where you are in the world, when it's 3 p.m. Eastern Time, that we're drumming. And we're drumming to Miss Kim's Lift Every Voice, and it's the push back these demons, these evil people that are walking around trying to do harm to us.
Divine intervention.
Yes.
Divine intervention.
You sang with Marvin Gaye, didn't you?
Yes, sir. It takes two.
Okay. Yeah, that was one hell of a birthday party.
Oh, what happened?
You know, funny. I brought some guests today, some people from Memphis just happened to be out in L.A. They gave me a call. I said, yeah, come on by. You know, I got a stretch coming to get me. The hotel's nearby, but you're welcome to come over, and we can ride over to the location, the Whiskey. I said, oh, okay. And they were, wow, who do you know? And I said, you'll see. So. When it started, remember she walked to the door, everybody said surprise, but she ran over to me, and that much impressed all of the Memphians.
Well, Judge, you know what? I'm going to play one of Miss Kim's songs. Okay, you ready?
I'm ready.
Mr. Okay, here we go, y'all.
The Black National Anthem. Let our rejoice.
of the fate that the dark past has taught us. Sing a song full of the hope that the present has brought us. Facing the rising sun of new day, let us march on till victory is won. Stony the road we trod, bitter the chasing rod, filled in the days when hope, when hope unborn had died, yet with a
difficult days ahead. But it really doesn't matter with me now, because I've been to the mountaintop. And I don't mind. Like anybody, I would like to live a long life. Longevity has its place. But I'm not concerned about that now. I just want to do God's will. And he's allowed me to go up to the mountain. And I've looked over. And I've seen the promised land. I may not get there with you. But I want you to know tonight that we as a people will get to the promised land. So I'm happy tonight. I'm not worried about anything. I'm not fearing any man. My eyes have seen the glory of the coming of the Lord.
Okay. Well, Jester, that hopefully that refreshed your memory.
Yes. Several ways. You know, I was the last judge on that James Earl Ray case.
Yes.
Did he shoot King? He did not. The FBI supplied the murder weapon. They supplied the ammunition. Ray's rifle got excluded when I had the test rerun on it. It was nowhere close to being consistent with what killed King. So we have some things that are unanswered. And we need some people brought to justice. Unfortunately, just about everybody involved is now dead.
Yeah.
But we learned what happened. And we can... make sure it doesn't happen again, but we keep trying to do the exact opposite. Now, our black caucus is letting us down because they seem to think the FBI is our friend. It's not. It got set up more than 100 years ago to catch Jack Johnson, the first black heavyweight champion of the world. It got created to set up the basis for the Mann Act, which is recently, they went after R. Kelly and convicted him under that. And it went on from there. And if you check out the Smithsonian Channel's television reports and the History Channel, and now the Smithsonian Institution is firmly convinced that J. Edgar Hoover was a black man. His parents had a big problem Louisiana with the Klan because the Klan found out they were trying to pass for white. And they ran them out of Louisiana. and King.
Oh, wow.
Hoover hated the Klan, but he hated the fact that he was black worse. So there's nothing worse than somebody that despises what they are, because they will give their own people a harder time than anybody else. And if you look at if you look at his youthful pictures, you will see somebody that looks very much like, oh, somebody you might know locally, former U.S. representative from the 9th District, Harold Ford Jr. And that's an interesting backstory. They've never been our friends. The proof came out, and after, you know, I retired, the case became moot. I didn't leave it. I just kept after it, dogging it. And I wound up getting the invoice, via the invoice, for 5 rifles that did match the profile of what would have had to have shot King. The FBI got them on invoice in late December 1967. They got 5,000 rounds of the very special ammunition that matches precisely what they pulled out of King's body. Late April 1968, that was the month King got assassinated, the Justice Department ordered the FBI to return those 5 rifles to the Defense Department because they were experimental sniper rifles. And the FBI claimed that they lost one. So I have the serial numbers of the 4 they returned. I have previously from the invoice the 5, so that one that was supposedly lost is the murder weapon. The FBI recruited a 2-man hit team in Quantico, Virginia, where the FBI has a training academy, and it's also on the same base as a Marine sniper school. So apparently what they did is they just walked over and said, hey, we want 2 people. How about you and you? We've heard good things about you. We want to do 1 more mission for the cause. There's this Negro that's getting out of hand, and he's a commie agent. He needs to be taken out. And that means you have an absolutely secure thing. It's not any mob. It's not any crackpot. It's not a crank like so many have out there with what they think happened. And the interesting thing is that the investigation we did shows that, amongst other things, there were probably at least 4 alternative scapegoats. Now, the interesting part about it is the homicide squad of the Memphis Police Department was adamant that Ray was not the assassin. And, in fact, they knew where he was, and that was not even inside Memphis. And wound up getting a video affidavit and a written affidavit from the first detective on the scene, and he talks about these things. We have a lot of other stuff, and there was an interesting thing where years later I got approached through one of my associates with somebody who had invented this algorithm that the U.S. Department of State and the Defense Department use, where it's not a polygraph test or a lie detector test as such. You require, though, a clear video of somebody speaking, and the algorithm analyzes the tone, the body movements, and the words, and it will give you an assessment on a scale of 0 through 34 from bright red to bright green, and indicate whether somebody is lying or not. In fact, she gave us a demonstration, which I found cute. We were sitting in a bar listening to some guys rap to the women, and we were getting an assessment as to whether somebody was being truthful. So they were using it to assess bin Laden speeches and Gaddafi and Putin and such like. So they wanted a baseline on what they thought was a guaranteed liar. So they rented 6 hours of the last tapes anybody did on James Earl Ray, And they were shocked when they found out he was way off deep in telling the truth, except on two things. And the only two things where he wasn't deep into the truthful zone were two questions where he equivocated. And basically the questions were, if you didn't do it, do you have any idea who did? And he's saying, I'm not sure. Now, why did it brought to my attention? At that time, remember, Guantanamo was in the news and about the torturing that they were doing for the prisoners down in Guantanamo?
Yes.
Some U.S. military and naval officers were very concerned about their oaths of office and felt they might be getting asked to compromise them by going along with what happened. So they wanted to figure out whether they were being told the truth. So they took this device, and they were going to get to the bottom of things. And that's how, when they wanted to get, wanted to correlate everything, and they found out Ray was not lying, that's when they came to me to find out what the story was. Another untold story, and this is a scoop for you guys. Guess who wanted to do a week-long series on it because they wanted to make a saint out of him, but they were trying to figure out how. The Vatican.
Oh,
they
wow.
They wanted to make Martin King an after-the-fact saint, and they wanted to finance research into what was done to find out what happened. So there's a lot that's gone under the bridge, so I don't talk off of my hat. And the state objected to me on McKay being on the case because in the process of being a criminal defense lawyer, I acquired every scrap of information I could on ballistics and firearms, ammunition and all of that. And I can be a pretty good student when I want to. And they objected that I knew more about ballistics than their experts did. But the appellate court said, well, that's tough. You take the judge as you find him. So,
yes, Judge, we have another caller, and we got 1 minute left, so hopefully they won't cut us off. Hey, Brother
okay.
Ray.
Good evening.
Brother
Good evening,
Ray.
Everybody. Yes, can you hear me?
Good evening.
Hello.
Yes, we can hear you.
Okay,
yes,
Judge, I'm so glad I listened tonight, and I want to thank you for what you said, and you've convinced me that I need to help you out here to get elected. And I think we all need to come together and make sure that your level of thinking gets in office across this nation. I'd also like to say that you know, we knew about J. Edgar Hoover. We knew who he was. We knew that James L. Ray did not kill Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. We knew that there were those of us in the ministry, supposedly, who were part of the conspiracy that that murdered Dr. King. And we also know now, today as we speak, that that element still exists and are still in power in this country. And we are organizing to address those issues because humanity depends on it. And as Dr. King said, that we have a spiritual and a moral obligation not to cooperate with our own demise. And I think that's a clarion call for us to take a stand. That's what the drum call is. We must take a stand now, and I'm just so grateful and thankful for what you've said tonight, and you got my support, and I hope that the people listening will go in and support you all the way and find candidates in your communities that you can support who are not a part of a system that has been strangling us since they allowed us to participate in their system. When they came, they found our system, and they found us here first. So I just want to thank you for tonight, and thank you, Antoinette, for having you on. And I hope that that listeners will step up to the plate and let's get Joe Brown in office here.
Thank you.
That's
see, I
want to
make it a Mexico country.
You're more than welcome.
Get a quick break and come to Memphis. Just as long as you're legal, you're not going to have a sanctuary city. We have enough problems with the folks that belong here. Now, that said, let's make it happen.
I'm with you.
Thank you for the opportunity,
yeah.
by the way.
One
other
thank
thing
you
I have, before I run out of time, let me add this. Because of what I just told you about, I have these records secreted in various places around, they want to discredit me badly so that what I say won't be accepted. They want me to be held out as a crackpot and a crank because I don't buy into this line. See, it's a dangerous thing when somebody says, I figured out what you did. I know what you did, and I put it down, and people will find out, if not now, later. And you have an accounting that's going to come. But they want to say, charge that. Now, one other thing about the accusation about the people who wear the cloth that may be complicit, I told what I know to various of the actors or people involved. And the ones that I did not suspect all said, we need to get to the bottom of it. The ones that I had under suspicion all said, let sleeping dogs lie. Exactly that. Now,
oh,
if you want to find out about where the blame should lie, Dick Gregory, before he died, recorded an interview he did with one of them. And that person was asked, why did you duck back in the motel? Well, I didn't want to get shot. Well, how did you know somebody was going to get shot? Well, I just tried to, well, it just seemed like under the circumstances, he might have. Now, there you go. Listen to what Dick Gregory said. It's still out there, or what he reported. And by the way, that was not Jesse Jackson. Jesse Jackson was one of those who said, we need to get to the bottom of it.
And as I said, there were others in the ministry who were there. I know what you're talking about. And yes, but again, you know, it's what we do now that's going to make a difference for the future. And if we do nothing, people, if we do nothing, we're going to repeat that history. So it's on us, and it's only on us. We are the ones. This is our time now, but the only way to get ourselves together and get over it is to organize, come together and deal with this. And I think Joe Brown's a great leader for this whole movement, which is taking place as we speak.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
Yes, absolutely. I agree.
Hey, you're right about that lie detector machine, man. They got some serious ones. And you're right, Judge, man. They got some serious ones, man. I'm telling you, you're right, man.
Your Honor, I had the privilege of being a part of Carl Stokes in Cleveland, and whatever I can do, please let me know.
All right. Still on, or have we run off?
Yes,
already?
We're still on overtime. It's not recording now, but we're still on.
Okay, we're just talking. All right. This is kind of like what happens on Friday to the Hunger Game things.
Yep.
And then y'all are still on.
Well, before you all leave, March the 23rd is the day of the Tuskegee Airmen Commemorative Day this year. It's the fourth Thursday in every March, and that's what we need to work toward as far as the Tuskegee Airmen are concerned, making the fourth Thursday in every March Tuskegee Airmen Commemorative Day. Thank you.
Ma'am, Ms. Weston, I'd appreciate it if you'd call in tomorrow and talk to Madam Dolores Brown, a widow of one of the airmen who is chairwoman of the Tuskegee Airmen's.
I know Ms. Brown. I've worked with Ms. Brown.
All right.
So,
Ms.
Kim,
on tomorrow.
I see the number, Ms. Kim. Ms. Kim, I see the number to his show tomorrow, okay?
For those who are not or who are listening with something to write or quick with your iPad, it is 929-477-1167. 929-477-1167.
I believe that was the group that Mayor Young was with, the 477 Bombers.
That's it, 477 Composite Group. That's the one. I misspoke and said 422nd. It's 477 Composite Group. They had P-25s and P-51s. B-25s and P-51s. They were training outside of Detroit.
But that Freeman Field situation, I can't remember what state that was in. It wasn't in Michigan, though. But we have, what's the name of that? I can't even think of the name of the field that we got. But they say they were just as prejudiced there as they were anywhere else.
Yeah, they were. They were. Tell you an interesting book with an associated thing on the 761st Armored Regiment. It was known as Patton's Panthers, Black Panthers. The Deacons for Defense and Justice in Loudoun County adopted that image, the Black Panther image and the name, and then the Black Panther Party adopted that back in the mid-60s. So the 761st is probably the second highest decorated unit in the U.S. Army. They didn't get the big decoration, but they were second behind the frontier unit that served down in Italy, that Japanese division. Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, the basketball playing great, is a scholar. Always was. You never saw him at UCLA without a long slide rule clipped to his belt. He was an engineer, if I'm not mistaken. He wrote a book on the 761st, and the reason he got interested is because he had an uncle whose nickname was Uncle Shorty, who was in the 761st, and he decided to cover them, not realizing his uncle had been in it. It's interesting. Also of note as a member of the 761st was Jackie Robinson, the baseball player who had played baseball and run track at UCLA, and he talked about how Jackie Robinson refused to go to the back of a bus in Texas, returning to the base, and wound up pulling his .45 on the MPs and the local police and the Texas Rangers and got court-martialed. He was acquitted, but he revoked his waiver of a physical immunity because he got his ankle hurt playing football at UCLA. And he said, what am I going to do? People said, why don't you go down to the colored leagues? He said, well, I've never played baseball. He said, yeah, but you're the fastest man in America. And when you get up the bat, you're such a good athlete, everybody backs up 15 feet. So he went on with the Dodgers with Roy Campagnolo and Don Newcomb, who wasn't but 17 at the time. He was a pitcher who, incidentally, is the only pitcher in Major League Baseball that's won every pitching award. And in the same backfield with Jackie Robinson at UCLA was Don Barksdale. Don Barksdale ran track and wide receiver on the UCLA All-American team. And he wound up being the first black man to play basketball with the NBA. The Lakers hired him, even though he had never played basketball before. The quarterback, who was redesignated tailback from racist prejudice at UCLA in the same backfield, was Kenny Washington, who became the first black man to play in the NFL. The Rams hired him. All these brothers got hired in 1946-47. So it's interesting they were all teammates playing football. None of them except Kenny Washington got hired in the sport that they had achieved such note in. So it's an interesting story, and there's a hookup right in there when you get with the 477 composite, and the 332nd started off as the 99th Pursuit Squadron. Is it? Oh, well, history lesson.
Yes.
Let's not forget the Red Ball Express. The Red Ball Express, man. It was a bad brother, too.
Well, I know about them. My father was breveted up to Master Sergeant in the Red Ball Express. He had been a platoon sergeant. They made the runs up with Patton when the Third Army went up there to stave off the Germans and the Ardennes. That's the Battle of the Bulge.